do the following statements from government or corporate officials have in common? I have here in my hand a list of 205 State Department employees that were known to the Secretary of State as being members of the Communist Party and who nevertheless are still working in shaping the policy of the State Department. Cigarette smoking is no more addictive than coffee, tea, or Twinkies. If you like the health care plan you have, you can keep it. Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us. Well, they are all statements that were not true. They were lies. And we will talk about the lies we are told and why it's so hard for our media watchdogs to uncover the truth. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with the author of 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. And we'll welcome your questions for him. We'll welcome maybe some examples of lies that you hear on your favorite media source. Why do you suppose government and corporations get away with this? Why is it even if the media does expose the lie that people continue to believe the lie after many years? Our guest is Charles Lewis, best-selling author, national investigative journalist for outlets that include ABC and 60 Minutes. He is founder of the Center for Public Integrity and several other nonprofit organizations. His most recent book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being with us. So why do you call the book 935 Lies?
Well, a group of researchers and I, for 2.5 years, put together a 380,000-word database of all the false statements involving Iraq from 9/11 to 2 years after 9/11 of the 8 top officials, or the most public officials who made comments. And that number we came up with, that we found, there were 935 false and erroneous statements made. And so that's mentioned in the prologue of the book, but that is where that number comes from. It was released in 2008, around the 5-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and it got massive coverage around the world, and the White House denounced it within hours. But most media outlets in the U.S., or many of them at least, covered it because no one had actually done that, research, actually adding them up.
Yeah, so what is an example of one of the 935 lies that we were told in the build-up to the Iraq War?
One of my favorites is that we found the weapons of mass destruction. We found biological laboratories. That was in May of 2003, about roughly 2 months after we went into Iraq, which was not true, and the president later, the White House later said, oops, that's not correct. But that's after we went in. But, I mean, the other one, there was a British statement. It actually was not by a U.S. official. I think it was a British official, but it got massive coverage around the world that the U.S. could be attacked within a matter of hours from Iraq, and that the British had intelligence along those lines. But there were so many of these. I mean, literally 935. And there is a database. The Center for Public Integrity at the website has something called Iraq the War Card. And you can actually look up some of these online and look at when they were said, who said them, who said the most of them, all those types of things of the 8 officials.
You know, when is a false statement a lie as opposed to, I don't know, as opposed to we don't really know yet, or this is what we think?
Well, no, it's a really great question. And actually, that is a bit of a conundrum because we don't know. There is such a thing as a person believes what they're saying as a matter of conviction that they think it. Nietzsche, the the German philosopher once made, said the worst thing than lies are convictions that they actually believe. And if they believe it, is it a lie? That gets into your head a little bit. I mean, it's almost need to be a shrink to know the answer to that. When we first released the report in 08, we called them false and erroneous statements because that was unmistakable. We knew we would not have access to interview any of these eight officials because generally they have not had much access to the media about their statements. But I think it's a fair point that at some point after many years, it came to seem to me pretty apparent that there was something fundamentally dishonest. So if you read the memoirs of all the folks involved, with the exception of the press secretary, Scott McClellan, who openly, flatly said that they had they were dishonest in the statements and was, of course, denounced within minutes by everyone else in the Bush White House. All the rest of the folks in their memoirs said that, gosh, there was bad intelligence. Well, anyone who remembers how closely everything that happened, the folks that were pursuing the intelligence, I mean, literally physically going to the CIA, creating a separate intelligence operation inside the Pentagon to counter and add to what CIA was doing to try find these weapons, find this intelligence that showed there were weapons. All of that was instigated by the administration after they came into office. So there's a lot of evidence that suggests there was some sort of previous thought process that the public didn't know. The first cabinet meeting, we learned from one Treasury Secretary's memoirs, they said, what are we going to do about Iraq? And it was not a big topic in that particular election, 2000 election. No one knew that that was on anyone's radar really as a major problem. And it was many cabinet officers were startled. So, I mean, when you put it all together, I think at some point it dawned on me, at least, that at some point it's not longer any longer a false and erroneous statement. Actually, there was some degree of, shall we say, an agenda, and there were statements that were orchestrated over a period of time at precisely key moments, which is we also tracked the when of the statements, not just who said them and what they were.
Yes.
And when you put it all together, it really did not seem coincidental, that's all I can say. And so, that's when I have come to the general view that I think it's not unreasonable to use the word lie.
Who was questioning these statements at the time?
A very, very few number of reporters. There were three reporters at the Knight Ridder Washington Bureau, which is now the McClatchy Bureau, and they're still working for McClatchy. There, Walter Pincus at the Washington Post, longtime reporter covering national security, had some questions because it seemed to him it wasn't adding up that there was any real evidence. But really, I have to say, there was a very, very small number. I mean, probably less than 1% or 2% of the national news media. Most of the media was covering every statement made by the White House and all of the various agencies, which, of course, were all in sync and all being coordinated. They were all saying the same thing every day, pretty much. And so people were doing what they usually do. They cover what people in power say. That is news. And that's what got amplified in millions and millions of words around the U.S. and around the world. And the din became rather thick and rather loud, and it was very, very hard to then reverse that narrative of, oh, no, actually, are there weapons? You know, very few people could even get a word in edgewise in the midst of that din.
Yeah, so why are they just, you know, covering what the people in power are saying and not checking out, well, gee, does Saddam Hussein really have weapons of mass destruction? How, you know...
Right.
We might go to war if we don't find this out.
Right. Well, you know, doing reporting on the ground in various parts of the world, including Saddam Hussein's Iraq, is not easily done. And it's not always, of course, safe to do. But inside Washington, of course, you're pretty much a prisoner to those in power, meaning you are limited in who you can talk to, where you can go. I wouldn't say you're led around by the nose, but, you know, there's briefings every day, and your job as a beat reporter at a bureau is covering what they say, essentially, and what they do. and they'll tell you what they just did, and you'll have a very almost no other way of knowing it easily other than them telling you. And if you don't get an exclusive interview with some of the officials of whatever agency or the White House that you're covering, then you'll actually be reassigned by your news media organization because you don't really, you're not trusted by those in power, and you don't have access. A lot of this is access journalism, and so it's always worked this way in Washington. That's not new. But in a situation where the nation is reacting from a horrific thing, you know, September 11th, where I would say some of these things were exaggerated even further because the government, everyone looks to the government when there's a national crisis. And when you combine all those, it's a sort of a toxic brew there of what's going to occur. And that's kind of what happened, I think.
And we certainly will talk about other major instances of untruths, of lies being told to us. But talking a little bit more about the lies that were told about the war in Iraq, after it was determined there were no weapons of mass destruction, we did not find any weapons of mass destruction. Why is it that still today, if some people are polled, they'll say, yes, we went to war with Iraq because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I mean, there is a syndrome where if you hear something repeatedly, you tend to believe it is the truth. That it has been scientifically shown in numerous studies. It's actually known as the illusion of truth syndrome. so there is something that actually does exist as a phenomenon with human beings in a general way. But of course, we all know that also we have a deeply partisan divided country, and we have for years had that, but it's gotten, I would say, pretty severe. And so as there was one poll as recent as 2012 that over 60% of Republicans still believe there were weapons of mass destruction, and that basically was years after the President of the United States himself, George W. Bush, who had made the decision to go to war, had already said, no, they're not there, and he had announced it. But even then, folks from his party still believed it. So people are generally also reluctant to change their beliefs once they have them. They'll decide that what they heard and what they thought once has to still be true, and they just don't change. They're stubborn. You know, they stick to their views about it. And information, including new information that might be correct information, is sort of incidental.
We are talking about how the truth is manipulated by governments and corporations and other entities, talking about some of the lies we have been told that have led to wars, lies about tobacco that hurt our health, lies to cover up wrongdoing like Watergate, lies to sell public policy like if you like the health care plan you have, you can keep it. And we're wondering why this happens. We're wondering how this happens. We're wondering if you have noticed this happening. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So what misconceptions or untruths do you see in public discourse, and who do you blame for perpetrating them? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Are we getting the full picture from our media, from our government and other institutions that communicate to us? We are talking with a journalist of television news and the author of a book, 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity, about the lies we have been told. And we welcome your questions for him. We welcome Any examples you might have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Charles Lewis is a best-selling author, national investigative journalist for outlets that include ABC and 60 Minutes. You know, we have lots of callers, but I guess I wanted to talk a little bit more on what's in the book. Besides the Iraq War buildup, what are some major instances of lies that you have witnessed during your time in the media?
Well, I think the one that most took me aback in the 9 years of research for this book is tobacco. 100 million people died from smoking-related illnesses in the 20th century, and a billion, with a B, people in the world will die in the 21st century. And from 1940 to 2000, the tobacco industry, despite a growing number of studies, that was like 12 or more by 1952. It was clear to scientists that it killed, that it created lung cancer and other things. And it, for the next 50 to 60 years, and eventually convicted of, in a federal opinion of federal racketeering by a U.S. judge, the industry deliberately, with lawyers, executives, front groups, everything, had this whole masquerade that they were looking into it and they worried about the public's health and meanwhile making money. But the media also had trouble covering it. And I, there's a chapter called Doubt Is Their Product, taken from an internal tobacco memo in 1968 that admitted that they couldn't advertise based on the merit that smoking is good for you, but they doubt is their product. The longer they could have doubt, the more people would keep smoking and buying cigarettes. And so they essentially knew they were killing people for decades. But also the media attempted to cover it numerous times all the way up into the last 10 years of the 20th century in the U.S. without success. And I detail exactly what occurred in that regard. And it's pretty alarming. And I was in the midst of some of that at one TV network and have friends at the others. And I tell the inside stories of what happened, how stories were killed, rather than making air, to show some of the truth about that.
Is there a difference between the lies that our government told us prior to the Iraq War and the lies tobacco company executives told us in terms of, I don't know, motivation?
Well, sure, certainly in terms of motivation, I think there is absolutely a difference. In the case of the tobacco industry, they're making, you know, astonishing sums of money in the billions, even tens of billions, even hundreds of billions of dollars. The motive in the case of the Iraq War was, you know, it's been ascribed to a number of things, but it's more ideological or personal, some have alleged or suggested. I don't know what the exact motive was, but it was definitely, there was some sort of agenda about that country that had very little to do with 9/11. Many people have sort of concluded, since there was very little evidence of any, there was no evidence of any substance, of any connection or WMD found, or for that matter, a substantial Al-Qaeda threat. So, that to me is more of an ideological or political motive as opposed to a financial motive. So yeah, the motives can differ, absolutely.
Well, we have so many calls. Let's yeah, go to them. Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi, good morning. I have always been a skeptic since I was a little kid, I guess. And I kind of always questioned statements by whether it was my teacher or the mayor of the town or the police officer or whoever. And it seemed like it, through the years it's become less and less popular to do that. I'm in my 70s now, but you know, back in the 50s and 60s, you could question something and you were given a fair hearing. Now it seems like you get shouted down. You know, when I started to question the reports on Saddam Hussein, I was like the enemy of the people that were in the room. And I think what's happened is this has gone down into the education system so that when you're in grade school and high school, you're taught to accept authority and not to question things. And as far as politicians and business people, they're all going to lie at times. And it's up to the public to question that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem we have today.
Well, what about that? It's our responsibility to question, and maybe we're not being taught to question as much as we used to be.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point made, and you know, I've had three different manuscripts on the way to publication, but textbooks in schools are a whole other issue, and locally throughout America, there's always a fight about how to characterize our history and what to say and what not to say, and countries all over the world, not just the U.S., are known to airbrush their story, shall we say, or their history that's taught. But at every level, I mean, I think there is an incredible pressure to conform, whether you're a student or whether you're just a citizen, one of, you know, a couple hundred, 300 million. There is a need to fit in. If there's a national crisis after the U.S. has been attacked, you can imagine how vulnerable emotions and all those other things are, and I think you're then maybe more susceptible to being told and led and conforming, and that's pretty much what occurred, I think, and back to what we were talking about. But these are a problem for, I think, all of us, and it's true in every country. This is not unique to the U.S. This book could have been written about any country on earth. That's the sad part. This transcends the U.S. itself. It's a deeper phenomenon. But anyway, I take the point. I think it's an excellent observation.
Oh, what is observation that, I think he's saying that today somebody who's a dissenter is likely to get shouted down more than in the past. Do you have any sense that's true?
Well, I haven't studied that, but, you know, we notice it with political campaigns. You know, we're about to enter another one. It seems like they never end, by the way. They're longer and longer each cycle. In fact, this one may have already started last year. But, you know, when there is someone angry at a microphone after they say something that seems a little loud or untoward, and they're at the mic, therefore a problem, or they don't have a mic but they're just loud, they're usually escorted out by security within seconds, if you've ever noticed. And I think it is. You can ask a sort of awkward or difficult or embarrassing question for the people that you're talking to, but it does start to, we're almost out of time. You can just hear the kind of things where you start to be shunted down. I've noticed it in a number of public settings where there are folks who often do point things out that are inconvenient, shall we say, to whatever the subject or gathering is about, and they'll be shunted aside. And I don't know if it's increased, but it seems like there's quite a bit of it, and I haven't tried to measure that. But, yeah, I understand what he's saying, and I think there is a concern that we are shepherded in certain ways fairly routinely, and that's somewhat disturbing, I would say.
Mm. So, Charles, why aren't we outraged? I don't know. Why aren't we, we get lied to and we go to war, we get lied to and we die of cancer, we get lied to and all sorts of consequences, and we're not outraged by this?
You know, that is the question for the ages. You know, I did, with the Center for Public Integrity, three Buying of the President books and a Buying of the Congress book about the role of money in politics, which is a fact, and we had 5 or 10 data sets showing how the amount of money had risen and how things seem to be awfully closely tethered to the money. And, you know, with the public, I think, is substantially disengaged. I mean, look at our elections. Half the country doesn't vote in a presidential, and in a local election, it's like 70%+ doesn't vote. And we have a country that has decided to, in many cases at least, to tune out, or that everyone feels powerless. I think it may be substantially the latter, powerless. and therefore why bother? You know, trust in the U.S. government, for example, went from 3 out of 4 Americans in the mid-60s to 30 years later, 1 in 4. As you probably well know, Congress's approval rating right now is 7%. So if everyone is holding their nose, understandably, about what's happened or not happened lately in Congress, there's not a great incentive to go vote because we've concluded that the whole thing is a mess and corrupt. Therefore, what good is it to vote in this election? I don't happen to believe that. I vote in everything. But I think there is a tendency to throw your hands up figuratively, and I think a large number of the public has done that. Everyone's working hard also, sometimes 2 jobs, and frankly, that's all the major thing that they want to deal with, and they figure that they can control, and frankly, they have to deal with daily. And so that's why we turn to sports and movies and things that are not so serious, because we can't change the world, and we're resigned to it.
Next, we go to Cliff in Appleton. Hello, Cliff.
Good morning.
Morning.
When the argument was made about if you like your health care insurance, you can keep it, I think the intention was genuine and sincere. The Affordable Health Care Act had no provisions that you would have to change your insurance. But people twisted those words and tried to make the argument that he was lying to the American people. Insurance companies have always had the ability to cancel insurance. And I blame the Republicans, some because they're just partisan and want to oppose the other party. But I think Obama has had more than his share of problems like that, because many of the Republicans, I believe, have racist minds and bigoted hearts. That's just my personal impression. So he's the president they love to hate.
President Obama famously made statements like, if you like your health care plan that you have, you can keep it. Was that a lie, or did the Republicans twist his words to make it seem like?
Well, I was uncertain about that myself, and I'm not an expert in everything that occurred on that health care plan. I did not study that systematically. But PolitiFact, which won the Pulitzer Prize, which does fact-checking, which is a group of journalists that are not, they're not partisans on either side, they found that the president had made 37 statements about that, and in fact 4 million Americans did lose their insurance. And yes, I take the point that insurance companies pretty much seem to have always done pretty much what they want to do. The regulation of them seems awfully lax is a whole separate issue. I think in this instance it is true. He said something that 37 times that was not correct. At one point you start to scratch your head, well, maybe just made a mistake, but if you say it 37 times, is it a mistake or are you consciously clinging to something? It wasn't done in 1 month or 1 week. It was said over an entire year where people kept saying it's not true. And yes, the Republicans were saying it, but it turns out actually it was not true. That happens to be a case where they were correct in their criticism of Obama. So I think it's reasonable to say that's a false statement, and I think it counts as in my view as a lie, in that they had to have known. They're not stupid. They're extremely bright folks, and the White House, they knew it was not correct. You had to know after one or two times because of the things you're hearing back. You got to be responsive. Lying is error by omission and commission, and if you don't tell things, do you notice we had almost no discussion in the 08 campaign about the use of drones? No one knew Obama would quintuple the use of drones overseas from George W. Bush. And they would not acknowledge their use of drones, but then the White House would leak to reporters that another al-Qaeda person had been killed by the U.S., wink, wink, and they were sort of trying to have it both ways. So every president in power, and really regardless of party, has a control of information. We have more PR people with this president than Bush had. Bush had more than Clinton. Clinton had more than his predecessor. So the more handlers we have and the fewer journalists we have, we now have 1/3 fewer journalists than we did in 2000, professional journalists, and we have 4 times more public relations people since John F. Kennedy and Nixon ran for president in 1960. Today, it was 1-to-1 ratio then. Now it's 4-to-1. So you have all these factors where distortion is much easier than it used to be, and the number of truth tellers trying to get the facts has diminished.
Yeah. So this is an example. If you like your health care plan, you can keep it. That's a PR person's or a spinner's talking point. Isn't that what that is?
I think it's a talking. Yeah, I think that is what happened. And I think that in a perfect world, if you have the most benign explanation, they should have changed it when it became clear it might not be true. And then you say, well, is it fair to blame the president? Well, we don't know the inner workings of the White House. The Freedom of Information Act does not apply to the White House or the Congress, ironically. And we don't know what their intent is. We don't have their emails, and we never will. And so given all those situations, we have to base it on what the president says. We don't know and can't know exactly what he knew. No one has access to that level of information.
Yeah. BJ on Facebook asks, will your guest please comment on government pressure on major news outlets, which results in compliance by the press? I recall, he writes, the Reagan State Department refusing to give access to those members of the news media who reported critically on their policy in Central America.
Well, as a matter of fact, I have a whole chapter on the Latin America secret wars, as a matter of fact, in this book. And I have some sections, and it's not the preeminent thing that I talk about in the chapters, but yes, it is absolutely true that we have a problem with limiting access. When I ran the Center for Public Integrity, we did a 110,000-word report with 10 researchers tracking the Pentagon's policy about how to handle journalists from Vietnam to the first Persian Gulf War. And they made a decision to remove reporters from the scene. And back in Vietnam, they were having body bags in people's living rooms on TV for the first time in U.S. history, and they didn't want to see that anymore. So the Falkland Islands, where they have ships 10 miles away and no access to any of the carnage, is what they wanted. And that's how the British did the Falklands, and the U.S. said, we got to do the same thing. So in Grenada, Panama, first Persian Gulf War, journalists were nowhere near the action. Deliberately so, and formally as a policy by the various administrations, the first Bush administration, and also Reagan during the Latin America stuff. But all of these are deliberate policies by the media handlers, and it generally works.
We are talking with Charles Lewis. He is an investigative journalist. He is the founder of the Center for Public Integrity, and he is an author, best-selling author. His most recent book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. The 935 lies in the title, they just refer to the lead-up, the false statements being made as the lead-up to the Iraq War, many other lies that we have been told, many other untruths that we have been told by government and by corporations. We're talking about why this is and whether something can be done about it. We'll talk a little bit about that next. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Charles Lewis, author of 935 Lies, talking about how the truth is being manipulated by governments, by corporations, by other entities, talking about the lies we've been told, how these lies are spread, why some still believe lies that have been exposed, and why our media watchdogs are struggling to bring us the truth. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let's talk a little bit about our media watchdogs. You did say that there are fewer journalists than there are PR people, Charles Lewis, but we talked about some other things, obstacles in the way of our media. But, you know, there's There's the you know, there's the internet, there's citizen journalists, there's you know, there's a lot more access to information and a lot more ways that we can investigate these things. So when you talk about the future of truth, where do you see this going?
Well, I think it's like everything in life, it's complicated. You know, we have hundreds of millions of websites. We have a lot of information on the internet. A lot of it's not true, as a matter of fact, or it's opinion. The question is, who's going to cover the school board meeting, and who's going to cover the facts of the matter, whatever they are? And my favorite part of this book is the real-time truth charts. I look at 10 years of misrepresentations by government and corporations and how it takes years to find the truth, sometimes decades. I think you don't have to lie anymore, just delay the information, just the actual truth for months or years. And the public has already, the attention span is so short, you know, sound bites used to be 40 seconds, then 20 seconds, then 8 seconds. Now we're down to 5 or 6 seconds. You know, most local TV stations, 1% of their news is about politics or government. The rest is what they always do, the car accidents and, the sports stuff and all that kind of thing, but not actual issues of our time. And so the things that are promising, I mean, I don't know how promising they are, but it shows you what's happened. In 40 countries around the world, citizens have gotten really mad and said they're not going to take it anymore and created truth commissions. You have an explosion in non-government organizations trying to find out information, publishing studies. You also have now 100 nonprofit newsrooms, investigative reporting newsrooms. You have a great one right there in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, Wisconsin Watch. I happen to, full disclosure, be on the board of that. But there are groups like that. Back when I started the Center for Public Integrity, it was the second one in the U.S. Now there are 100. And there are groups like this now sprouting up around the world. Now, is that enough? I would say no. I think it's pretty obvious it's not. There are very highly talented news gatherers, you know, reporters and editors in the U.S. in the commercial realm still, very much so, and around the world. And I think the public has to have more than one source, just like reporters, of information. And we have to stay on top of what they're doing, and we have to watch those in power. And the worst thing we can do is ignore them and just throw our hands up. I think that would be that's a disaster waiting to happen.
Let's take some other calls. Rich in Rhinelander is with us. Hello, Rich.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Mr. Lewis. I'm wondering what proportion of your book deals with what I consider the two big lies in American society, that is, we live in a post-racial society and we live in a post-sexist society. We have in our Supreme Court almost a holy office that issues an imprimatur in terms of, if you look at the Hobby Lobby case, anybody who says that closely held corporations have religious rights, but the women employees of those corporations have less or less important religious rights in terms of their personal beliefs about reproduction. I mean, that's just a howler to me.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I got one out of two of the things you mentioned. I have a whole chapter on race, and I examine the history of information about race, about how we covered it, how the journalists covered it, how it was discovered. You know, the New York Times didn't have a bureau in the South until 1947. It wasn't part of the U.S. in their view. I'm joking, but not entirely. And what happened on the issue of race, and yes, the assumptions that we make because we had two landmark laws that we think we took care of those problems, and what really has happened in the case in that whole general subject of race and how that's got a fundamental lack of truth and candor and realism about what is happening in the country and still happens today. I did not, as it was, my manuscript kept getting smaller by the editors at the publishing house. I should have done women, too. Yes, that's a really important issue, absolutely. You only have so many hours in the day, but I take your point. I think both of those things, I think, can be aptly described as some progress appears to have been made in recent decades, but anyone who has illusions that it's exactly where it ought to be is also mistaken. mistaken.
Yeah. On the other hand, I do recall criticism of some media outlets for focusing on, for example, at a Tea Party rally, maybe a sign that has a racist message on it, or somebody makes a racist comment, and then painting the whole group as being racists, and the people who were members of the Tea Party were saying, "Hey, that's a falsehood."
Well, I know, and that's where I have to say that's where being a journalist is really, really difficult. Because they don't want to just show a group of people walking, and if they are all mostly white and they don't know what else to say, I'm not defending that, but I understand how complicated it is. When you're in real time, you're out there and you're doing a minute or 30 seconds to a minute for a newscast, and you don't want to just say, here's the Tea Party, and it is a loaded thing to say that. You're absolutely right. Unless you have data that shows that this kind of thing is made repeatedly, these kinds of the composition of the folks, but more importantly, what they say and what they do and what their policies do. Obviously, most reporters don't have the time or take the time to be able to even make that assessment. And when you're out covering something and you're at a local station covering five stories a day, you end up having that kind of journalism, and it ends up being a photo op with a quick thing and someone making a quip, and that's what passes in many instances. Not NPR, thankfully, but many other outlets as "quote unquote" news.
We have Rick in Rochester with us now. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Firstly, and Charles, for the intelligence and the courage and the strength to go for the truth. I'm a 57-year-old male, obviously, and I can say that the damage that's been done in my life on a personal level and a career level comes from lies. And, I think that also applies to our country. We're not living in the truth and doing what we say we're doing was destructive to us. But the political stuff I get and all that. But on another level, on this program, I listened to a program on this book called The Big Fat Surprise. And I would say that the decisions or the information we get comes from the money. Those that control the money and the power give us the information. We just want to make good decisions for our lives. But like that book points out, and sorry I don't have the author's name in front of me, but we could all make better decisions if we had the truth. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, just to put a little bit more context, because I know you don't know that particular author that we interviewed, but this was a book that was saying that fat is not bad for us, and the different conflicting scientific studies when it comes to nutrition, and saying what we once thought was the truth turns out maybe it's not the truth. So there's that problem too, Charles?
Right. Well, there is. I mean, well, there are so many layers to this question and an answer, to be fair. There are so many studies about everything, and I'm not an expert on fat. I like many Americans, I wish I had less of it, honestly. But I'm not an expert on that one. But I do think we do have a significant problem about information and truth, and the media is actually complicit. I don't mean to pin it back on the media, but we forget that we're the only advanced country in the world, a democracy in the world, that does not have free airtime for politicians. The reason our elections are so expensive is because the paid advertising has gone through the roof, over $1 billion every cycle now for commercials. And so no one covers local politics in the media, the electronic media, particularly TV, because they have an incentive not to cover it, because the only way to get heard will be to buy ads. And that's what passes. And McCain and Feingold separately told me the most powerful interest in America, no doubt in their mind, what is the big media, broadcasters, TV in particular. They control your face and your voice, not just give millions of dollars in lobby like all the rest, but they have that power. So it is very, very difficult for things to filter through to the public that are not already sanctioned. Now, probably if I hammered that issue, I would commercial radio and TV stations would probably be less interested in having me even discuss this book. So I think we have all kinds of cross-current issues here and problems, and this is an example of nothing here is as simple as the other problem, which is unfortunate.
You know, we also hear a lot about how people seek out information that tells them what they want to hear or something that they agree with, something that is tied to the success of Fox News and MSNBC because they focus on opinion. If people only listen to what they want to hear anyway, how can more truthful information be heard?
Well, I totally agree. I mean, we basically have a bifurcated media in a lot of cases, and I must say it's particularly noticeable with cable TV, which I have a very hard time watching just because I don't want to. The whole thing makes me crazy. I think we have the Hatfields and McCoys type thing with the way it's shaken out. And we also have a perpetual campaign. The reason we always have a campaign is in the off years, it's in their interest to have people hate each other and go to their source for that. The audience is always higher for the party faithful than it is for neutral folks who are just trying to figure out, look at CNN's ratings in relation to the other two you mentioned in cable. So, yes, there's a problem there, and I don't know what we're going to do about it, but it is a continuing problem, and I actually think it's a worsening problem, and I don't know what the answer is offhand, except I helped a group get off the ground called the News Literacy Project, and its motto is how to know what to believe, and 150 journalists, met, some of them retired, go around the classrooms in high schools in several cities, trying to help teach them and show them that you have to have multiple sources of information and how to make sure you know what you've just read or heard is actually true. And that there's something, there's a huge need for that in this country. We can't just not pay attention. We do so at our peril.
Yeah. Well, we just have about a minute or so to go. What else do you think we need to be investing in to fix the problems that you see?
Well, I mean, I think the public has to get engaged, maybe enraged over these things and demand more than what we demand of our folks. We need, I think the other thing is keep watching. One of the things I want to do is take all the great knowledge. I mean, we have the best reporting in the world on human rights is Human Rights Watch, not the New York Times. They have 400 people in 19 offices, so there are a lot of experts that we put over in a category and we call them experts, but we don't talk to them all that often. And that information and knowledge needs to become more accessible to the public, the general public. And I'm trying to find a way to broaden, knock down walls that are just journalism and broaden them to include experts like social scientists who have data and other things that help us reveal the truth. So we have to expand the parameters of what we know and what we can see and, frankly, open up the transparency that we also lack. Increasingly, we are losing our access to information by the government and elsewhere. Now we have to keep our eye on that, too.
Well, I hope you'll let us help in that transparency. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Charles Lewis, author of 935 Lies. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Justin Williams for producing this program. Thank you for listening. Tomorrow at this time, it's The Week in Review. Two guests of opposing political perspectives with their take on the week's top news stories. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.